Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in the next two half-hour segments, we're going to be discussing something which, in a sense, could be said to be the raison d'etre for this program. One of the reasons, the main reason that I have engaged in this line of research and endeavor over the years is to try to bring to the American people, or as many of them as I can reach, the truth concerning some very important events that they will need to know about in order to intelligently govern their lives, and some events which unfortunately have not received the attention due them. So what we're going to be doing this evening is examining part of the history of the influence that elements of our intelligence community have exerted on the news media. Specifically, we're going to be taking a look at the history of the journalistic community's involvement with the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, as a quick aside, our intelligence community is much larger than just the CIA. The CIA only gets 15% of the intelligence budget, but nonetheless, that very powerful institution, again, the Central Intelligence Agency, has exerted a profound influence on the functioning of the U.S. news media over the years. Research credit on the following article goes to a member of the listening audience. This comes from the Namebase Newsline newsletter, specifically issue number 17 from April and June of 1997. This particular article was authored by a very fine researcher named Daniel Brandt, last name B-R-A-N-D-T, a name well known to veteran researchers in this field, and some of his characteristically excellent work is accessed in the Namebase Newsline newsletter of April through June of 1997. And once again, that's number 17. Daniel Brandt has entitled this particular article, Journalism and the CIA, subtitled The Mighty Wurlitzer. By the way, that term, The Mighty Wurlitzer, was the nickname given by former Deputy Director of Central Intelligence Frank Wisner to the CIA's media component, something that he was instrumental in developing. Now, for people who would like information about Namebase Newsline and how to contact it, it's edited by a Steve Badrich, or Badrich, B-A-D-R-I-C-H. And you can reach him and or them at P.O. Box 680635. P.O. Box 680635. That's in San Antonio, Texas, 78268. Once again, P.O. Box 680635, San Antonio, Texas, 78268. Their telephone number is area code 210-509-3160, 210-509-3160. Fax number, same area code 210, same prefix, 509. The last four digits are 3161. Again, the fax number, 210-509-3161. The email address for them is info@pix, it might be P-I-X, this is a small Xerox, .org. Again, info@pix.org, or perhaps it's pix, P-I-X, .org. And their website is www.pix.org. Okay, or perhaps PIX. Again, this is a relatively small Xerox, and my middle-aged and capable but failing eyes can't quite discern that. In any event, Daniel Brandt's Journalism in the CIA, The Mighty Wurlitzer, begins as follows. And I'm going to read this article straight through during the succeeding half-hour segments, as well as a very fine sidebar about the influence on the American news media of members of the Council on Foreign Relations, a very influential body, sometimes incorrectly represented in certain types of right-wing conspiracy theory, but a very, very influential body nonetheless, and one that exerts a powerful influence on the news media, and also one that overlaps the U.S. intelligence community to a considerable extent. Daniel Brandt's Journalism in the CIA reads as follows. Alongside those Greek morality plays and biblical injunctions, we are also reminded by history itself that the use of unethical means to achieve a worthy end can be self-destructive. Power, by definition, is isolated from the correcting signals of external criticism. Or perhaps the feeling of fighting evil fits so comfortably that it's difficult to shed even after objective circumstances change. The history of U.S. intelligence since World War II follows both patterns. The Office of Strategic Services, the CIA's predecessor, had jurisdiction over wartime covert operations and propaganda in the fight against fascism. OSS Chief William Donovan recruited heavily among social and academic elites. When the CIA was launched in 1947 at the beginning of the Cold War, these pioneers felt that they had both the right and the duty to secretly manipulate the masses for the greater good. OSS veteran Frank Wisner, W-I-S-N-E-R, ran most of the early peacetime covert operations as head of the Office of Policy Coordination. Although funded by the CIA, OPC wasn't integrated into the CIA's Directorate of Plans until 1952 under OSS veteran Alan Dulles. Both Wisner and Dulles were enthusiastic about covert operations. By mid-1953, the department was operating with 7,200 personnel and 74% of the CIA's total budget. Wisner created the first, quote, information superhighway, unquote. But this was the age of vacuum tubes, not computers, so he called it his, quote, mighty Wurlitzer, unquote. The CIA's global network funded the Italian elections in 1948, sent paramilitary teams into Albania, trained nationalist Chinese on Taiwan, and pumped money into the Congress for Cultural Freedom, the National Student Association, and the Center for International Studies at MIT. Key leaders and labor unions in Western Europe received subsidies, and Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty were launched. The Wurlitzer, an organ designed for film productions, could imitate sounds such as rain, thunder, or an auto horn. Wisner and Dulles were at the keyboard directing history. The ethos of the fight against fascism carried over into the fight against godless communism. For these warriors, the Cold War was still a war. OSS highbrows had already embraced psychological warfare as a new social science. Propaganda, for example, was divided into, quote, black, unquote, propaganda, stories that are unattributed or attributed to non-existent sources, or false stories attributed to a real source, quote, gray, unquote, propaganda, stories from the government where the source is attributed to others, and, quote, white, unquote, propaganda, stories from the government where the source is acknowledged as such. After World War II, these Psy War techniques continued. C.D. Jackson, a major figure in U.S. Psy War efforts before and after the war, was simultaneously a top executive at Time Life. Psy War was also used with success during the 1950s by Edward Lansdale, first in the Philippines and then in South Vietnam. In Guatemala, the Dulles brothers worked with their friends at United Fruit, in particular the father of public relations, Edward Bernays, B-E-R-N-A-Y-S, who for years had been lobbying the press on behalf of United. When CIA puppets finally took over in 1954, only applause was heard from the media, commencing 40 years of CIA-approved horrors in that unlucky country. By the way, I would interject that the 1954 CIA overthrow of Jacobo Arbenz had nothing to do with the overthrow of communism. Arbenz wanted to reform Guatemala, which was essentially a feudal society, and to turn it into a modern, market-oriented capitalist society, specifically modeled on the United States. However, in order to do this, he appropriated scores of thousands of acres of United Fruit-owned land. That obviously did not sit well with United Fruit. They then used their influence within the National Security Establishment and CIA to overthrow Jacobo Arbenz. Continuing, Bernays' achievements apparently impressed Alan Dulles, who immediately began using U.S. public relations experts and front groups to promote the image of Ngo Dinh Diem as South Vietnam's savior. The combined forces of unaccountable covert operations and corporate public relations, each side able to tap massive resources, are sufficient to make the concept of, quote, democracy, unquote, obsolete. Fortunately for the rest of us, unchallenged power can lose perspective. With research and analysis, the capacity to see and understand the world around them, entrenched power must constantly anticipate and contain potential threats. By the way, I realize why I stumbled. I believe this was meant to be, unfortunately for the rest of us, unchallenged power can lose perspective. I believe this is an editorial mistake, hence the hesitation. So I believe that should be, unfortunately for the rest of us, unchallenged power can lose perspective. Continuing. But even as power seems more secure, this capacity can be blinded by hubris and isolation. Troublesome notes were heard from the Wurlitzer in the 1960s, but not from American journalism, which had already sold its soul to the empire. Instead, the announcement that the emperor had no clothes was made by a new generation. Much that was dear to this counterculture was stylistic and superficial, and there were many within this culture itself, and certainly within the straight media, who mistook this excess baggage for its essence. Nevertheless, the youth culture's rumpled opposition was sufficient to slow down the machine and let in some light. The ruling class failed to see the naked contradictions that they had created. They expected that the most privileged, best-educated generation in history could be forcibly drafted to fight a dirty war against popular self-determination some 8,000 miles away, a war that clearly had more to do with anti-communist ideology and corporate greed than it did with the defense of America. The elites didn't have a clue that this was even a problem. President Johnson's knee-jerk response to the student anti-war movement, for example, was to pressure the CIA into covering the nefarious and non-existent foreign influences behind it, Thus, the crack in the culture that eventually encouraged American media to take a look at themselves. With rare exceptions, it was the alternative press that began to question racism, police brutality, Vietnam, the defense establishment, and the JFK assassination. In 1967, Ramparts magazine exposed a portion of the CIA's covert funding network, whereupon the New York Times and Washington Post began naming more names. By then, the Wurlitzer would never sound the same, particularly after the 1968 assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy invited further suspicions. The counterculture burned out once the war wound down, but it had already dented the lemming-like consensus that typified an earlier period. For roughly 10 years between 1967 and 1977, Americans learned something of their secret history. From the perspective of 20 additional years, the results were mixed and much remained secret. But it's scary to think of where we might be now if the counterculture had never happened. During the last half of those 10 years, sandwiched between Watergate coverage on one end and congressional investigations of the CIA on the other, the media showed some interest in examining their own intelligence connections. The first shoe was dropped by Jack Anderson in late August of 1973, when he revealed that Seymour Friedin, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, F-R-E-I-D-I-N, head of the Hearst Bureau in London, was a CIA agent. Friedin, already in the news because the Republicans paid him $10,000 in 1972 to spy on the Democrats, confirmed Anderson's story. At that point, William Colby, the new CIA director, was asked by the New York Times and the Washington Star News if any of their staff were on the CIA payroll. James Scotty Reston of the New York Times was satisfied with an evasive answer, but when the Star News editorial board met with Colby, they made some progress. The other shoe dropped with an article by Oswald Johnston on November 30th. The Star News learned from an, quote, authoritative source, unquote, in parentheses, Colby, that of course is former CIA director William Colby, continuing, that the CIA had some 36 American journalists on its payroll. Johnston named only one, Jeremiah O'Leary, who was one of their own diplomatic correspondents. The Star News stopped publishing in 1981, at which point O'Leary joined Reagan's national security staff. From 1982 until his death in 1993, he was with the Washington Times. That was the first and last time that Colby was helpful on this topic. Some believe that the new director was under pressure from the Young Turks, junior staffers at the agency, who were granted a mandate by Colby's successor to cough up the, quote, family jewels, unquote, a list of illegal exploits that could be culled from the CIA's files. Already, there were rumors that the CIA was guilty of illegal spying on the anti-war movement, rumors that were confirmed a year later by Seymour Hersh, some of whose sources were these same Young Turks. Why was Colby initially forthcoming on the issue of the CIA and the media, and why did he then start stonewalling? Some believe that he was attempting a, quote, limited hangout, unquote, as the best way out of a position that made him nervous, while others feel that he was implicitly threatening to provide additional names in order to scare off the media. Colby had reason to be worried. By late 1973, investigative journalism was in the air because of Watergate, an issue that had more than the usual share of CIA connections. Colby's stonewalling continued for the remainder of his tenure, even as a Senate committee led by Frank Church desperately tried to squeeze more names out of him. George Bush replaced Colby in January of 1976, by the way, I would interject that, of course, as Director of Central Intelligence, continuing, and eventually agreed to a one-paragraph summary of each file of a CIA journalist with names deleted. When the CIA said it was finished, the Church Committee had over 400 summaries. The committee staff was shocked at the extent of the CIA's activity in this area and felt that they still didn't have the story. But they were running out of time and expected that the Senate's new permanent oversight committee would continue their work. The Church Committee's final report contained only a handful of vague and misleading pages on the CIA and the media. Quote, "It hardly reflects what was found," stated Senator Gary Hart. Again quoting, there was a prolonged and elaborate negotiation with the CIA over what would be said, unquote. The House investigation of the CIA under Otis Pike had more problems than the Senate investigation. The full House voted to suppress the committee's final report under pressure from the executive branch, at which point Daniel Schorr of CBS leaked a copy to the Village Voice. This report contained just 12 paragraphs on the topic of the CIA and the media, including the tidbit about the CIA's, quote, frequent manipulation of Reuters wire service dispatches, unquote. Another paragraph gave some idea of the scope of the CIA's efforts in this area, and then it quotes that paragraph. Some 29% of 40 committee-approved covert actions were for media and propaganda projects. By the way, the 40 committee, interjecting and interrupting, was one of the early directorial bodies for CIA covert operations. So that is what the reference to 40 committee is. It basically was one of the bodies which not only advised but oversaw and participated with the CIA at an executive directorial level with regard to covert operations. So that's the reference here. Beginning again. Some 29% of 40 committee-approved covert actions were for media and propaganda projects. This number is probably not representative. Staff has determined the existence of a large number of CIA internally approved operations of this type, apparently deemed not politically sensitive. It is believed that if the correct number of all media and propaganda projects could be determined, it would exceed election support as the largest single category of covert action projects undertaken by the CIA. One, and then author Daniel Brandt goes on to add, that of course was a quote of that paragraph from the report. One enterprising researcher took this 29% figure and, extrapolating from figures on CIA expenditures for covert operations, found that the cost of propaganda in 1978 was around $265 million and involved 2,000 personnel. Comparing this to figures for other news agencies, he concluded that the CIA, quote, uses far more resources in its propaganda operations than any single news agency. In fact, the CIA propaganda budget is as large as the combined budgets of Reuters, United Press International, and the Associated Press, unquote. By the way, I would also interject that this article is copiously footnoted, so interested listeners or readers who would like to pursue the sources upon which Daniel Brandt has drawn for this excellent article are certainly able to do so from his documentation. Continuing, CBS took Daniel Schorr off the air after he leaked the Pike Committee report. This was most likely a convenient opportunity for William Paley, chairman of CBS, who didn't approve of Schorr's interest in the network's own CIA connection. By the way, I would interject that William Paley himself was a veteran of U.S. government psychological warfare operations in the World War II and early Cold War periods. By the way, a good reference on that is the book The Science of Coercion, authored by Christopher Simpson, the author of the landmark book Blowback about the incorporation of the residua of the Nazi intelligence system into our own at the end of World War II. The book is published in softcover by the Oxford University Press and is currently available. So again, by way of assessing William Paley, background in the psychological warfare establishment of the U.S. government, the book The Science of Coercion by Christopher Simpson. Continuing, former CBS News president Sig Mikkelson, M-I-C-K-E-L-S-O-N, who by 1976 was president of Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, said that in October of 1954, Paley called him into his office for a friendly discussion with two CIA officials. Schorr mentioned this on Walter Cronkite's show. And in an op-ed piece for the New York Times, Arthur Hayes Sulzberger, the late publisher of the Times, had been cozy with the CIA also. There are executives and retired executives, Schorr wrote, again quoting, who could help dispel the cloud hanging over the press by coming forward to tell the arrangements they made with the CIA, unquote. Little had changed since 1974, when Michael J. Harrington, a Democratic congressman from Massachusetts, leaked Colby's closed-door testimony about CIA involvement in the 1973 coup in Chile. Harrington soon found himself the target of a formal ethics committee investigation. Now, Schorr was also their target. Apparently, Congress was fearful that the executive branch might paint them as bungling and irresponsible when it came to keeping secrets, and then use this as a club to deprive them of access to information. If Congress felt this way, it was more than simple paranoia. In 1976, the CIA began cranking up their Wurlitzer on the matter of Richard Welch, a station chief in Athens who was assassinated by urban guerrillas at the end of 1975. The CIA's exploitation of this timely tragedy had both an immediate target and a general target. Ostensibly, the CIA was complaining about an obscure Washington magazine called Counterspy, which had been printing CIA names. In the same spirit, Philip Agee's just-published diary of CIA tricks in Latin America was loaded with names and was already an international sensation. But the general target of this campaign was more important. The CIA managed to change the nature of the debate. Suddenly, it was no longer a question of what dirty work the CIA might be doing, but rather a question of what happens when the press recklessly endangers the lives of our brave boys overseas. By the way, the AG book is on company business. It's called A CIA Diary. Actually, I may be misrepresenting the title on company business, but it's called a CIA Diary. That's the subtitle. Off the top of my head, I've forgotten the title of Philip Agee's first book. He also has a second follow-up volume called Dirty Tricks. By the way, note again that the CIA has only 15% of the overall intelligence budget, so in assessing CIA deeds and misdeeds, one should not make the mistake of seeing the CIA as the most important part or even the bulk of U.S. intelligence. Again, it only gets 15% of the intelligence budget. One does not hear, for example, about the National Security Agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Army Security Agency, the Office of Naval Intelligence, the Office of Special Investigations, or OSI, Air Force Intelligence, all of which are very, very powerful. Some, in my opinion, more so than the CIA. Continuing. The fact that Welch's name had been published by the East Germans 5 years earlier, and that he could be, identified as a CIA officer from his listing in the unclassified 1973 State Department Biographic Register, were both ignored. In any case, it was hardly a secret in Athens. The group that killed Welch had been stalking his predecessor, Stacy Hultz, H-U-L-S-E, until Welch moved into the Hultz residence 5 months earlier. Colby eventually admitted to a House subcommittee that Welch's cover was inexcusably weak, and that the publication of his name in an Athens newspaper had only an indirect effect on his assassination. Colby could say this 2 years later, because by then his comments were destined for a back page. The battle to reign in the CIA was already lost. In 1982, Congress passed a controversial new law that made publication of CIA names a felony under certain conditions. Although these conditions rarely applied to journalists, the wide coverage on this issue served to intimidate most publishers and editors. Today, the CIA, which once issued an automatic no comment when asked anything by reporters, is playing an adept game of soft cop, hard cop public relations. In 1991, an internal CIA task force recommended a more active posture by the public affairs officer when responding to requests for assistance. That year, they handled 3,369 telephone inquiries from reporters, provided 174 unclassified background briefings for them at headquarters, and arranged 164 interviews with senior agency officials. The, quote, hard cop, unquote, was discovered by Katrina Vandenheuvel, editor of the Nation. By the way, remember the name Katrina Vandenheuvel. We're going to see her name later on in a sidebar provided by Daniel Brandt as one of a number of journalists who are affiliated with the Council on Foreign Relations. Again, a very powerful body which exerts a powerful influence over American national security and journalistic and political policy. Continuing of Katrina Vandenheuvel, Daniel Brandt writes, in 1995, she was telephoned by Vin Swasey, S-W-A-S-E-Y, CIA Deputy Director of Public Affairs, who strongly objected to an editorial because it included the names of 9 former station chiefs in Guatemala. Reuters was persuaded by Swasey's colleagues to run the story without the names. The final months of 1977 produced 3 significant pieces of journalism on the CIA and the media just before the issue was abandoned altogether. The first by Job Trento and Dave Roman reported the connections between Copley Press and the CIA. Owner James S. Copley cooperated with the CIA for 3 decades. A subsidiary, Copley News Service, was used as a CIA front in Latin America, while reporters at the Copley-owned San Diego Union and Evening News were instructed to spy on anti-war protesters for the FBI. No less than 23 News Service employees were simultaneously working for the CIA. James Copley, who died in 1973, was also a leading figure behind the CIA-funded Inter-American Press Association. And that is also mentioned in the aforementioned Philip Agee book, The Inter-American Press Association. We're going to continue with this reading and analysis of Daniel Brandt's article in our next half-hour segment. I alluded earlier to the Spitfire Tape Duplication Service. They have all of the half-hour segments I've produced, the various interviews that I've done, the weekly One Step Beyond shows, most of the lecture tapes, and now the archive documentaries that I've produced over the years as well. Spitfire can be contacted at Post Office Box 1179. That's P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. Once again, that's Spitfire, one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005. There's also an email address for Spitfire. That's A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E. That's A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E at ix.netcom.com. Once again, that email address, A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E at ix.netcom.com. By the way, I've now updated our webpage to include all of the Spitfire information, descriptions, lengthy descriptions of the various archive shows, the half-hour segments, all of the programs available on permanent file can be accessed from the website. There's also a suggested reading list, some suggestions about some things to do, information about other means of publication I'm attempting to launch. I can't tell you about that on the air since that is a for-profit venture and this is non-commercial radio. But interested listeners can access the KFJC website. You can point your web browser at www.kfjc.org and look for the public affairs section, and then the Spitfire Dave Emery information should be perfectly readily available in the public affairs section. So again, point your web browser at www.kfjc.org and look in the public affairs section for descriptions of all of the various Spitfire tapes, suggested reading list, and other information. I can't tell you about other means, but I can give you the address at which to contact it. You can contact other means at P.O. Box 191710, P.O. Box 191710. That is in San Francisco, California, 94119-1710. Again, for other means, that's taken, by the way, from the famous quote from Prussian military theoretician Karl von Clausewitz that war is the continuation of politics by other means. You can contact them at P.O. Box 191710, San Francisco, California, 94119-1710. We will be continuing with this very fine article by Daniel Brandt about the CIA and the news media, specifically the CIA and journalism, in our next half-hour segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.